Thanks so much, Heather. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in from your desks, from your homes, from wherever you are. A big thank you. So I'm starting from the assumption that you all have some sense of what the lean-in phenomenon is. And what I really want to do for you today is provide you an economic perspective as to how we can approach some of the main ideas in the book Lean In. Okay? The first question that I want to address is, what can economics say about the fundamental issues around Lean In? And the answer is a lot. A lot of very smart people have actually defined economics and thought about economics as the study of choice. So today, what I want to do with all of you is go through the following. I'm going to go through the economic theory of choice and how this will have some implications for the whole debate around having it all and making choices. Economics has a lot of mathematics around the idea of choice, and we're going to talk today about boiling those concepts down and seeing how they can relate to the having it all debate. Then I'm going to talk a bit about the economic evidence of gender and economics, the value of women's labor force, and the explanations in the economic literature about the ambition gap and gender disparities. And finally, what I'm going to do is talk about some takeaways from what we learned today for individuals and companies. So where are we going to start from? Well, how does economic theory analyze choice? First, when we make a decision, economic theory tells us each individual is presented with a set of choices, otherwise known as a choice set. We cannot choose everything. If we did, we would not be making a choice, and nothing would be interesting about making choices. And our choices help determine our individual utility, alternatively referred to as fulfillment, satisfaction, happiness, etc., which we want more of rather than less. So this is a lot of complicated math for some simple beginnings. And what economics tells us is that the choices we make are important. We can think of the combined value of this utility, or how economics talks about fulfillment, reflecting our relative preferences for the elements in our choice set. So for example, my utility. It might be a function of spending time with my family, time spent grading papers, time spent cleaning my house, time spent reading a book. You can see cleaning my house has a negative impact on my utility, because I'm not very fond of cleaning my house. All of these things together combine to create my personal utility function. Okay? But as Milton Friedman famously said, there's no such thing as a free lunch. When he was asked, as an aside, when he was asked during his dissertation defense to boil down his 2,000-page dissertation to one sentence that summarizes economics, his answer was, there is no such thing as a free lunch. So similarly, when we think about utility, our utility function is subject to constraints. The most important of these constraints are things like time and money. Time being the most difficult of these, because we have only a certain allocation every day of a certain number of hours to the activities that create our utility. So with this scarce resource, we must allocate time to our utility function. Since we're limited in our allocation of time, we're constantly making trade-offs. By the very definition and by economic theory, therefore, we cannot have it all, because we can view life as a constrained optimization problem, where we're trying to maximize your utility subject to the constraint of time and other things. Therefore, this debate about having it all really undermines the fact that there is no possible way with the scarcity of time for us to accomplish having it all. Economic theory also talks about how can we increase an individual's utility? Other than relaxing the constraints, a lot of complicated math shows that the only proven increase in utility from a theoretical perspective is by expanding the choice set. For instance, by educating individuals about the strategies for maximizing the efficacy of their choices, this expands their choice set and increases their utility. Any other notion of what increases someone's utility is a non-economic argument. What this means is that economics respects individuals' preferences and makes absolutely no value judgment about the choices we make. Even though economics makes no judgment on how to increase utility, gender is an economic issue. Because when we aggregate, you can clearly see statistics of the economic importance of women in the workforce. More directly, the issue of women in the workforce is not a corporate social responsibility issue. It is a competitiveness issue. We can see that 40% of the GDP growth in the US in the last 40 years was related to increases in productivity from women entering the workforce. By 2028, women will account for 2/3 of consumer spending worldwide. But even though women have such an impact on growth, we're also differentially impacted when it comes to poverty and financial crisis. Currently, 14% of American women live in poverty. 40% of those women who head families are living in poverty. And 25% of African American women in the US are living in poverty. And the financial crisis has differentially impacted women and made it more difficult for women to escape poverty. So where are these issues coming from? Well, there's a couple of main issues. I've synthesized the economic literature to really focus on what I see as the main issues in gender disparity in economics in the US and around the world. The first is the wage gap, right? We've talked about the wage gap in economics and in the popular press kind of ad nauseum. We know that there's a wage gap. Controlling for certain things, the wage gap can be from 9% to 22% in the US. And this wage gap has implications for women in the workforce. Secondly, what I found fascinating when reading the literature is that patterns of attrition for women across almost every area are similar. Let me explain. So in corporations, we see that there's an equal number of men and women entering corporations. But somewhere along the line, the women are leaving and the men are staying and entering the C-suite. I'm going to talk a little bit later about what I think some possible reasons for this are. But another very, very interesting pattern of attrition that we notice is also in science and math education. So if we go back one step from the corporation level and talk about women in college, particularly women in STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math, women and men start out at equal footing when they're entering college, meaning in terms of math preparedness, by certain measures, women and men, college freshmen, have no statistical difference from one another in terms of their preparedness for the STEM fields. Yet, by the time women and men become seniors and graduate, by far more men are majoring in these STEM fields than women. Why is this concerning? Well, first of all, we believe that math is a very strong predictor of future income. Also, STEM fields, when we look at disparities in this in the wage gap and disparities in income, women who graduate with STEM majors and men are likely to make almost a third more than other majors upon graduation, given that they're employed. So we see that there is this importance and this focus for understanding why we're having this attrition problem of women from when they enter college to when they leave. So this same pattern of attrition, where somewhere along the way women are being lost, we can see in corporations, and we all can also see in universities. Okay? Why does this occur? The economics literature provides many reasons for why this occurs. There are hundreds of papers trying to get at the precise reason why we see these gaps, why we see wage equality. And the first of these, obviously, is discrimination. And I have here taste-based and statistical. Taste-based means I don't like women, I'm going to pay each woman less. Okay? Statistical discrimination actually means that it's costly for employers to find out information about your performance. So what they do is create some sort of proxy for your productivity based on what group you belong in. So the economics literature tries to delineate between these two types of discrimination to try to understand differences in the wage gap. Another reason why we see these disparities, particularly in the wage gap, is human capital investment. So we see that typically women have less training, less mentorship, and a smaller number of years worked. Some other causes that have been examined in the economic literature are attitudes and preferences. It's shown with a number of lab experiments that women are actually more risk-averse, respond differently to competitiveness. So it's thought that if those characteristics are true between men and women, then women are likely to enter fields that are less risky. So for instance, staying away from anything having to do with the market, financial markets. Also, what's fascinating to me is that the attitudes towards math and science, again, going back to the notion of STEM fields, the idea of STEM fields, the attitudes towards math and science are really quite different among men and women, especially in college and before. So when asked, even though test scores may not be statistically different among college freshmen, but when asked questions, how much do you like math? Do you think you're good at math? What is shown is that the attitudes towards women and math and science, even though test scores might not be statistically different, attitudes are very, very different towards math and science. And what does this lead to? All of these issues that we think might be causing wage disparity and discrimination and things like this leads to this idea of occupational segregation, both between industries, between firm, and within firm. Let me explain this a little bit more. Between industries, we see that if it's true that women are risk-averse, like I explained before, then we'll see that women will select themselves into certain industries that might seem less risky or more stable over time. Between firm, there's also this idea. We can see that even among the most successful firms, women select into smaller firms. So of course, the wages are going to be lower in the smaller firms. And also within firm, we can see that there's evidence that women also do have less of an ambition to reach the executive levels in firms. So due to this occupational segregation, the idea of discrimination then becomes the self-fulfilling circle, the self-fulfilling prophecy, where employers then discriminate based on the fact that they know or they think or they use as a proxy women who have been in their company before, who segregate themselves to different types of jobs, and then employers discriminate those women further. And it leads to this never-ending cycle, or what we call in economics simultaneous causality, such that women are kept in certain jobs, in certain areas, and in certain firms. So we can see from this that there's a myriad of factors that determine the disparities, some of which we cannot control. Well, what's the good news? This kind of sounds sad, and it's this self-fulfilling prophecy, and how can we stop it? And this is, economics is a dismal science. This is pretty dismal. Well, there is some good news in the economics literature. First of all, there's increasing evidence that nurture wins. So in a series of studies trying to address this idea of, well, women are born less risk-averse, what some economists have done is separated, put women and men into a laboratory, or girls and boys into a laboratory, and done a series of games with them, trying to see if they can tease out the relative risk aversion of the two sets of people, girls and boys. And then what they did is they divided the girls, some of whom had gone to all-girls schools and some of whom haven't. And what they found was that those girls who went to all-girls schools in terms of risk aversion and competitiveness performed exactly the same as the boys in terms of risk aversion. So what this tells us is that there's something about the way that those girls were nurtured that impacts their risk aversion. So there's increasing evidence that differences in attitudes and preferences that may result are actually a function of nurture and not of nature, i.e., something we can control and something we can impact. Secondly, the good news in the economic literature shows that there are high returns to mentorship and even higher returns to female mentorship. So this dismal evidence of women in the STEM fields and disparities in graduation rates in the STEM fields, it actually shows that with mentors, women, we might be able to close this gap. And in particular, it shows us that when women in college have access to female professors in the STEM fields, they are much more likely to A, take more STEM courses, and B, graduate as a STEM major, and C, pursue graduate work in the STEM field, and D, be able to obtain a job in STEM fields. So we can make a difference simply by becoming role models and by having those role models. So even though there's a myriad of factors that determine these disparities, the flip side of the coin, of course, some of these things we can't control, but there's increasing evidence that some of these things we can control. So what does this mean for employers and policymakers? I think the most interesting evidence in the economics field today is that these patterns of attrition are consistent in different areas. And I think employers, policymakers, academia, etc., need to focus on where and why this attrition is taking place, what's called the missing middle, because the similar attrition patterns, whether corporations or college students, et cetera, are all very, very similar. So instead of focusing on the end goal only, we should constantly be focusing on one step before. And what we learned at the beginning of this talk is that we need to address the trade-off. The only universal way of increasing the utility of women is by offering more choices and educating women about their choices so that they believe that they have more choices. So what does this say about Lean In? First, choices value judgmentless. There's a famous saying in Polish, some people like oranges and some people like when their feet smell, which basically says you can't make any judgments on anybody else and what they like in a very crude way. This is exactly what economic theory tells us. Choice is value judgmentless. Specific prescriptions about increasing utility are imposing some non-economic value judgment. We need to support choice. Due to the scarcity of time, we need to make full information about our choices and trade-offs. We need to educate both women, men and women, about their choices and about the choices they can offer. Similarly, employers should focus on giving their female employees education about their choice, education about the choice that they might have when they're considering leaving work for a myriad of reasons. The economy is a gender issue. Even though we know utility, we can't ascribe any notion about what increases utility except choice. The economy is a gender issue. So much of growth and the financial recovery and competitiveness focuses on women and turns on women. This high returns to mentorship that I've discussed before means that there's positive externalities. So this notion of not leaving before you leave doesn't just impact you, it impacts other women around you. As a female leader, you have the ability to exert these positive externalities on those around you through mentorship. And finally, similar to the idea in Lean In that we should focus on the changes we can make, there is increasing evidence in the economic literature that the fundamental issues in gender disparity, some of these issues we can directly impact and we can make changes on. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Sharon. I'd like to open things up now for questions with our audience. Please click on the hand icon on the right-hand panel of your screen just above the chat window to let me know that you have a question, and we can unmute your phone so that you can ask your question live. You can also type your question into the chat box, and I will read those questions aloud to Sharon. While folks are getting their questions ready, oh, I see Donna Fleming has a question. We'll go ahead and unmute that line now. Donna, what's your question?
Could you please clarify your conclusion? How would making a woman aware of more choices help? It seems to me that it would make the constraints even worse. In other words, I know I still only have 24 hours in a day, and now I have even more things I have to choose from and worry about. That still doesn't help me maximize the time I spend with family or weeding my garden or spending with my friends. It makes the choice worse. Could you clarify that?
Sure. So economic theory talks about what increases our utility, what choices we make. When we try to think about ways to impact that utility in terms of rationality of human beings and different mathematical properties, what it shows that only having an increase in their choice set is going to increase on our utility. From a day-to-day perspective, having more choices should not decrease your utility. It should only increase your utility because you feel like you have the opportunity to make different choices. You feel like there are more opportunities out there. So that's what economic theory tells us about choice. On an anecdotal perspective, we may have different behavioral responses to choice. And what economic theory would probably say is that changes to increases in your choice that decrease your utility violate kind of fundamental assumptions about rationality, transitivity, certain mathematical properties. So really I'm just saying that the economic perspective and what economic theory tells us about choice is that the only, strictly the only way to increase our utility is through choice set. On a personal perspective, that might decrease your utility, but the only way to increase it is by increasing your choice set.
Great question, Donna. Thank you so much. If you would just click on the hand icon once more, that will lower your hand. Again, I invite anyone on the webinar to submit your questions in the chat window or raise your hand and we can ask your question live. We did have a question come in chat from Emily. She says there was a recent NPR story about it being easier to be a woman leading into the emerging markets in BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. One of the reasons that was highlighted in the story was that childcare is much cheaper in those countries. What creative ways in America can we make that possible?
I think childcare, you have to excuse me, I didn't listen to that NPR story. My specific study of emerging markets does not have any indication that being a woman in an emerging market is easier at all. Women are subject, if you want to talk about wage gaps, I mean the wage gap in emerging markets is much larger. The number of girls who have availability to go to school is much smaller. So I'm not completely clear about what they said about being a woman in an emerging market is easier. But in terms of providing childcare, I totally agree. I think that is one of the main issues that we have in terms of getting women into the workforce and keeping them in there. I believe that the government, I think that there could be government subsidization of childcare, but I think also one of the focuses that Lean In and in general we talk about when we talk about college-age women leaving college-educated women leaving the workforce, typically this demographic doesn't have as much issue with childcare because they're in the workforce to begin with. Those women who can't afford childcare don't have the luxury of being able to work. So we have some issues. I think the government can help address these issues with subsidies and more availability of childcare. But again, I think it should be very clear and it should be consistent that women in emerging markets do not have it easier. If anything, they have it much, much harder than we do.
Okay, great, thank you. Another question here from Ryan Young. He says he's wondering to the extent that women leaving the workforce to raise a family impacts some of the observations you've made, for example, regarding wage gap, lack of mentorship, lack of women in C-suite. Do people just adjust their investment based on a lower expected return on that investment?
Can you repeat the question? Sorry, that was long.
Yes. So what extent does the chance of a woman leaving the workforce to raise a family impact some of the observations that you've made? Do people adjust their investment based on a lower expected return on that investment?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. Economic evidence shows, like I talked about, there's kind of this self-fulfilling prophecy in the workforce. So we have this notion that employers discriminate, and I don't mean in terms of I hate women, I mean in terms of, like I said before, statistical discrimination, where employees create some average measure of productivity or of investment that they have to make based on a group that you belong to. So for women, if they've had any experience in the past of women leaving that have been trained and they've lost money on, then they may not hire a woman or not promote her because she's a woman and they're basing it on that proxy. Similarly then, once they do that, women also are kind of discouraged ex ante from even wanting to get to that level. So you can see how it kind of creates this self-fulfilling prophecy, or as we say in economics, simultaneous causality, where it's just this cycle that has a very difficult time being broken because we have expectations and beliefs on both sides of the equation, on the supply and demand, or the woman and the employer are both having these type of expectations and beliefs that are reinforcing each other and are reinforcing the idea that women will leave, and then they do.
Great. Thank you, Ryan. Anne Underwood had a question. She's wondering, you know, for those of us who are parents of girls and we can't afford sending them to private girls' schools, what do you recommend to better expose and prepare them to risk and give them better attitudes towards STEM careers?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I can just speak to my opinion and my experience as a woman in a quantitative field and from what I observe in the classroom. I think one of the things that I find the most interesting is that the more in my classroom, for instance, the more I treat the women and the men similarly, the more the women tend to excel. So for instance, I have a very, what my students say, nasty habit of kind of cold calling and pushing my students to be analytical and critical all of the time. And the more that I call on women the same frequency with which I call on men and push them in just the same way, the more that they blossom over the course of the semester and become less risk-averse in terms of raising their hand and speaking out loud. So I think that's just one example of treating women with the same push that we give men in the same way. And I encourage you, if you have a daughter, the economics literature and the papers discussing all of these things are open to the public. You can research what about these girls' schools is kind of causing that gap to be smaller in terms of attitudes towards math and science. You can go online and research all of this and try to figure out what can you take from those lessons into your home. And I think on a personal level, it sounds fairly cliche, but in my house, we were always pushed in any direction that we seemed like we excelled. If my parents had some small notion that I was good at math, you better believe it that I was at math camps and I was being nurtured in that way, and in the home, doing math problems in the home. Just kind of not having any type of aversion towards math. I feel like from a very young age, that can have a very strong impact. And as a role model, if you're a mother in a home with a daughter, you know, don't be averse to math and science yourself. Be interested and show your daughter that you're interested in these fields as well. So I think that leading by example can really help. And also fostering relationships between girls and female mentors in these areas. The literature shows that when female college students have female professors, it is a huge increase in all of the indications that a woman's going to reach STEM field. So I think kind of seeking out female mentorship for your daughter and nurturing that as well. Just some ideas.
Great. Thanks, Anne. I have another question here. I am in my first job out of school and work in a Fortune 500 company.
Congrats.
And have seen a lot of bro club attitude, men going golfing after work or inviting one another to a basketball game if they have extra tickets. How can women network and thrive in such an environment?
Yes. So Heather left out a little bit about my career that I don't think about anymore because it was so long ago, but I spent 2 years in consulting and management consulting as well. I experienced that a lot too. So my first Christmas party at my company was kind of a shock because at some point all of the men went to one part of the room and started smoking cigars and the women were left on the other, and I thought, what is this, 1950? So what did I do? I lit up a cigar and walked over to the men and kind of they laughed at me, but I didn't care because I was still in the conversation. So that's just an example. I think it's very difficult to try to work your way into the male network. But I think don't be discouraged by it. Just, you know, try to make your way into it in kind of an authentic way. There are men who are willing to be mentors. Developing that relationship would be very, very important, was important for me. And I think for me, when I was in that position in management consulting, and I felt really different from, treated differently from the guys, was really, really seeking out female mentorship. There are loads of organizations now, largely as a response to the Lean In book, that are promoting kind of this new network of women in business, in academia, et cetera. So, you know, get on Google and start researching these groups that are specifically designed for women, and kind of constantly be on the lookout for female mentorship, whether it's in your firm or in another.
Great, thanks. I see we have a question on the line. Sorry to keep you waiting there, Alexis. We'll unmute your phone and please go ahead.
Hi, thanks, Sharon. I have a question about the data and sort of the perspective of looking at the U.S. versus other countries where childcare and parental leave is far more persistent and equal between men and women in places like Norway, Sweden, and the U.K., where mm-hmm. you have up to a year off to care for the birth of the child, and fathers are also encouraged to take extensive parental leave.
Right.
How much does that factor into your research, your conclusions, and or is it not something that we look at when we compare the U.S. Or what's happening here in this country?
Yeah, there is. I mean, there is research looking at differences in parental leave, and I think probably the biggest difference in those other countries, which are not emerging markets, those are well-developed countries. A lot of that research focuses on the idea that the attitudes are also very different. So when you see that a man took a year off when he had a child, when his wife had a child, there's a different attitude about that in, for instance, Canada than there is in the U.S. And there are different responses in the labor force and in the labor market to seeing on someone's resume that they took a year off to have a child. It's very well accepted in Canada, so then employers don't discriminate based on that. Whereas in the U.S., it's much less accepted. And we actually see that women who take off significant amounts of time for childcare or for care of elderly, we see that there is about a 30% decrease in income if you take off two or more years. So there is still this very big difference in terms of how we approach that. But again, on the employer side, it's not just discriminatory, it's also based on the fact that then you have a less number of years of experience than a similar man who's applying for the same job. So there's a bunch of different reasons why we have that 30% drop. It's not just discriminatory.
Yeah. Has there been any follow-up research about the flip side, in other words, the economic impact to GDP and other factors in these highly developed countries where these types of leaves exist, and how employers might benefit from them?
I'm not exactly sure about whether there is. In general, it's really measuring the impact of women leaving for a year is difficult to measure in terms of GDP. But I'm actually not familiar with papers on that.
Thank you for your question, Alexis. If you would be so kind as to click on that hand icon, that will lower your hand. I'm going to turn back to our chat window where Desi wrote in with a question. She asked, do you think that a federally mandated maternity leave period, similar as to yeah. Alexis's, as in Europe, would help or hurt women's success in the workplace in the U.S.?
Federally mandated
maternity leave.
Federally mandated. In terms of the economics of it, I'm not quite sure. My personal perspective is that when you have the government mandating time off, that makes me a little bit uncomfortable with the reach of the government hand into the choices we make. Again, I very strongly believe in choices and in the fact that increasing our choices increases our utility. So if the government mandated that, that's kind of putting imposition on choices. So from my perspective, I don't know how comfortable I would be with that. In terms of the impact on the economy, I'm not quite sure what that would be.
Okay, great. Thanks for your question, Desi. I'm curious, you spoke a bit during your presentation about the poverty rates of women in the United States. What about men?
Yeah, I mean, something that's important, I always tell my students whenever you say a statistic, it always has to be relative to what? Is this actually a lot? And in the case of poverty among American women, the differences are quite large. So for poverty among American men is only about 10%, and then poverty among American women is about 14.5%. So 1 in 7 women in the U.S. fall under the poverty line.
Okay. Tracy has a question. She asks, what does current research tell us about the same issues, salary disparity and underrepresentation in high-level management positions for women without children?
For women without children, there is still a disparity. Again, the wage disparity issue, when we control for a number of different things, getting back to this idea of occupational segregation, so when we control for industry, when we control for size of firm, a number of different things, the wage gap goes from 22% in the U.S. to about 9%. So again, there are a number of different things figuring out what impacts the wage gap. I think it's extremely difficult to pinpoint one thing that causes the wage gap because I believe there are so many inputs to what's causing the wage gap. And again, this notion of simultaneous causality, all of these things are creating a self-fulfilling cycle that make it very difficult for economists to truly measure the causal impact or the cause in terms of one specific factor.
All right. Kimberly has a question getting back to maternity leave. She's wondering, what about mandating that businesses have maternity leave as a choice?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think increasing choices for women is, again, I think that that is extremely valuable. So I think offering, as employers, the more of a menu you can offer to your female employees so that they'll be successful and productive and stay, the better it will be for women. But again, I don't think that the government mandating this is necessarily the right way to go about it. I think that educating employers and educating firms that gender diversity is not a corporate social responsibility issue or an ethics issue. Gender diversity is an economic issue. It's a competitiveness issue. It is costly to attract talent. It is costly when talent leaves. And there's such a large pool of untapped talent. So what we need to do, I think what the government should do, is educate employers and educate firms about this competitiveness. And once firms understand that it will increase their competitiveness to kind of offer more of a menu of options for their female employees so that they'll stay, I think firms will want to do this. And it will be optimal for firms to do this. And offering that menu will increase the choice for women and increase our utility.
Great. Thanks for your question, Kim. We just got a question in here from Lee. Why would the U.S. male-dominated society want to give a greater number of STEM jobs to women? It may increase productivity, but it also increases more competition for men.
So my interpretation of what you're saying, Lee, is that there's a disincentive for men to kind of increase the menu for women to enter STEM fields. And I think on some level, yeah, of course, in terms of incentives, it seems that way. But you also have men who are Fortune 500 leaders who have stock options in their company, who want to remain globally competitive. So I think the more that we tie the menu of options or the choices of available to women to firm performance and firm success, the more likely it is to kind of squash any type of disincentives for men to keep women out of STEM fields. Men who kind of perceive this disincentive have a very micro view and a very short-term view in terms of their own success. They're not thinking down the line. They're not thinking long-term for their company.
Great. Thanks, Lee. I'd like to bring this discussion back a little bit more to your research. What can you tell us about women during the financial crisis, and why were women disproportionately affected?
Yeah.
Or seemingly so?
Well, first of all, part of the reason women are disproportionately affected is because there is this wage gap. So when we see that wages are decreasing, it'll disproportionately affect women because we're making less money in the first place. Secondly, in terms of the recovery, we see that unemployment for women had a harder time in terms of recovery. And the reason why is, again, this occupational segregation where women are disproportionately represented in public jobs. So when public jobs were cut, it was more difficult for women to re-enter the workforce. So we see that unemployment was much more difficult for women in the recovery. So that's part of the reason why that women were differentially impacted by the financial crisis.
Great, thanks. Just a comment here from Deb. She points out that there aren't enough men to fill in all the future STEM jobs, and that STEM jobs have the highest growth rate of jobs in the U.S., so let's fill them with more women, right? Sharon, what are you doing currently that still ties back into Lean In?
I think I'm doing a lot on a personal basis, first of all. The first thing I think that kind of becoming involved with Lean In and thinking about it has done for me is increased my awareness. So a lot of the discussion in Lean In is talking about how a lot of the stereotypes that we have is not just for men and women, both have these stereotypes about women. So sometimes now when I'm trying to think about, on a day-to-day basis, any type of stereotype I may be imposing on anybody, I really try to take a step back and try to see, is it really a stereotype or is it based on that person's performance? So for instance, I just hired a group of TAs, 12 TAs for my undergraduate class of teaching firm strategy. And there were, happily, last year I had 0 women interviewing for those positions. This year, half of the people interviewing were women. And I very consciously tried to make a decision, A, not to discriminate in any type of way except based on their resume and their interview, and B, I also really think about mentorship kind of on a day-to-day basis. I think about, can I mentor women? Can I encourage any women in terms of pursuing economics? I had a student last year who was extremely bright, and she was studying something that was not in the STEM area, was not quantitative, and she thought maybe she would pursue economics, but it's really hard, and there's a lot of hard math, and I really tried to make an effort to kind of push her, and now she's actually majoring in economics, and I'm totally thrilled about that. So I think awareness, mentorship, I'm also trying to become part of the Lean In community, starting Lean In circles, and really the Lean In circle for me has just been getting back to the question we had earlier about networks, is kind of building your own network. Whether or not you are on the Lean In circle online or whatnot, just meeting with women and discussing that soft information about your job is super, super, super valuable. So I recently had some other female professors from my department over to my home just to chat. And really all of that soft information that men get from the old boys network, really trying to figure out how can I get that information? How can I get the mentorship I need? And kind of being more aggressive about pursuing mentorship, both giving mentorship and pursuing mentorship on my own. So many different ways.
Thanks, Sharon. Here's a question that just came in from Nina. She asks, if the economies on hiring and retaining women are so clear and convincing, why hasn't any organization or person come forward to state those facts publicly in the mainstream? She says her husband, a businessman who she met getting her MBA, and former corporate managers, mid and senior level executives, are not reading Lean In or listening to this compelling webinar.
So why do I think they're not listening? Is that the question?
Why hasn't, if the evidence is so clear, yeah. Why isn't there more talk about this in the mainstream media?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is an increasing discussion in the mainstream media. I mean, if you look at, since Lean In came out, the number of articles about this, there are increasing number of articles about it. The issue is whether they're men reading it or women. And I think you're probably right. I think it's probably mostly women. And I think that the more, in my opinion, the more that it can be framed as an economic argument, and even not necessarily a gender diversity issue or corporate social responsibility or ethics, the more we really focus on the fact that it's an economic argument. It's an argument about competitiveness. One of the biggest challenges in these large companies is finding and retaining talent. So when you start moving the argument towards, this is not even about gender diversity, this is about dollars and cents, and this is about the bottom line, I think more of a framing of this idea in that frame will really grab the attention of leadership of men in major corporations.
Great, thanks. I see it looks like Nina also has her hand raised. So I'm going to go ahead and unmute your line. Nina, go ahead.
Sorry, I forgot to raise my hand. But I guess my real question is, what organization or who is it that should be making some same formal definitive comments? Not the discussions or article in the framework of the economies.
Right.
Where should that be coming from? I mean, this doesn't seem as controversial as, you know, global warming, and won't take years to convince people, but no one's kind of emphatically stating and exploring and explaining why this is such a clear economic.
Right.
I think
it's an issue of awareness, and I think, for instance, McKinsey has a lot of different studies about the value of women for companies. Getting that material to executives, I guess, is partly your question as well. I mean, I think people in corporations who are dealing with these HR issues of attrition and of people leaving need to be provided this data, getting it to them, I'm not quite sure, but they should be researching them themselves. I mean, this is what companies hire people in HR to specialize in, how to attract and retain talent. These HR specialists should be aware of this data.
Great. Thanks for the question, Nina. We are about out of time, so if any of you have any other burning questions, please be sure and submit them in the survey that you will be directed to immediately after this webinar. I will share those questions with Sharon, and we will get back to you in the next couple of weeks. Thank you so much, Sharon, for giving today's webinar and sharing this great information with all of us. I also want to thank the CALS Alumni Association and PCCW for sponsoring today's event. And finally, I send my personal thanks to each of the Cornellians' parents and friends joining us this afternoon. We appreciate your participation in this important discussion. This concludes today's program, and thanks everyone again for participating.